ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So we've waded recently into the dingo thing and woof.
Was that a dog pun?
That was a shock. It's like being inside your house and going, I'm just going to go for a walk, and you open the door and suddenly a tornado smacks you in the face and the whole house gets blown up and you're like, wait, whoa, whoa, whoa. I just wanted to go outside. I just wanted to look around. Oh my God, no, this is all. I without getting into the number of papers and books and publications that have been written about this, I'm just aware that there are a lot of people who have, and probably very rightly, for a lot of very good reasons, strong opinions about how dingoes are classified, because that classification has major ramifications for what people can and cannot do to them legally.
Have you ever heard an evolutionary geneticist be so nervous? Yeah, let this be a warning to international researchers. Excuse me, shush. The dingo enclosure is one you enter at your own risk. On ABC Radio National, What the Duck is back with an episode of this series that has been most anticipated by the complaints department. It's dingoes, the Australian doggos. Now, previously in this series, we've heard that compared to their ancestors, ancient grey wolves, domestic dogs have largely lost the ability to work together as a team. They've shaken off a restrictive breeding cycle because we are such impressive producers of garbage. And they've specialised in reading human emotions, our actions, and being our very best mates. So then, if a wolf is a team-working, specialised hunter, and a dog is a sycophantic, large-eyed scrap eater, then what are dingoes?
You seem fine, and you're good.
Well, this one is absolutely gorgeous. The colour of a creamy ginger cat, black nose sniffing permanently, white socks, and a tail which has a surprisingly long floofen feather.
I am Kellyanne Blake, a Wadawurrung woman who lives on Jowra country.
And who's this?
And this is Jack, who...
He's wrapping me up.
Yeah. This is Jack, who is part of our family.
And Jack is a dingo.
Yes. Yes, Canis dingo.
Jack is electric. I can't take my eyes off him. And Kellyanne is taking Jack and I on a little bit of a walk. Now, Kellyanne has normal dogs and she also has Jack. So how are they different?
So, Jack has no recall.
That means Jack will not obey your calls to come here.
Come on.
He doesn't put your wishes above his own in that context.
The recall and the whole, oh, hang on, I will come to you, but it's on my terms, okay? I love you and I want to be with you, but I will smooch you when I'm ready.
Even as we're walking along, Jack is sniffing and scanning. But what makes it different from, say, a Kelpie is that there's a very serious business air about all of this activity, an insistence that seems God-given. He is so confident. I need to revise my earlier statement. I think Jack is the one taking us on a walk.
Also, they are double-jointed. Yes, they are double-jointed and they're nocturnal as well. My daughter has heard him do his little... They don't bark, but they do little yelps, like a little... I don't know how to put it. It's really high.
Look, he looked at you when you did that.
Yeah.
Now, I've never had a little pat with a dingo before. His tail's way more fluffy and sort of long-haired than I expected.
So he's an alpine dingo, which is why he's more fluffy.
Oh, you're a fluffy boy.
And female dingoes, when they've had pups, would use that as a blanket to blanket the pups to keep them warm as well.
Cute.
Yeah, and they put the tail over their nose to keep temperature in during the winter.
More from Kelly and Jack when we do a lap and come back around the corner, that is... if we can convince Jack to do that.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, come
Yak. Yak, yak.
Right. So, to find out what are dingoes, we sort of need to find out when are dingoes.
I mean, it's an accepted story that dingoes came over with human beings between 3,500 and 5,000 years ago.
Clive Wynn is a professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He studies the relationship we have with dogs.
Far from with the first wave, not with the second wave, a relatively late wave of Aboriginal Australians.
So if that's the date, the arrival would have been by boat with humans. So we're talking something we'd probably consider a domestic dog, because I think it'd be hard to convince a wild animal to take a shift on the oars.
So dingoes are descended from dogs that were brought to Australia by people about 3,500, maybe a little bit earlier than that, but certainly not much more than that.
Gregor Larson is a professor of evolutionary genomics at the University of Oxford. That means he studies the DNA that can be salvaged from ancient finds, as well as modern animals, to try and understand how X became Y, and in this case, how domestic doggos became distinctive dingoes.
Having arrived in Australia, some of them then leave that very close human connection and then start surviving outside of a human context.
And finding Australia to be so different from where they'd come from, they in effect reversed, at least in part, some of the evolution from the wolf to the dog.
Wait, it just dawned on me what this actually means, that dingoes are a long-time feralized domestic dog. They wilded themselves.
Now, some of those dingo populations have existed then for thousands of, a couple thousand years at least, outside of a direct human niche, if you want to call it, or anthropogenic stressor, or however you want to refer to these things.
So you have this totally unique animal, which is just so amazing.
But how did this happen, right? Because it took thousands of years for wolves to become dogs, and then thousands more for early dogs to look, sound, and act like the domestic dogs we know now. So why would all that hard evolutionary work be discarded when they arrived on a new continent?
It is really fascinating, and this is always the question I think to myself when I think about dingoes. I think, okay, did they make it to Australia and go feral? They didn't have that baked-in heavy reliance on humans yet.
Dr. Angela Perry is a zooarchaeologist. She studies early human-animal interactions.
They kind of got in before the storm, before the, like, dog can't just hunt, go off and hunt on its own. Did they catch it before that kind of set in? And it seems like the answer is yes, because dingoes and New Guinea singing dogs have no problem fending for themselves and being completely unreliant on humans.
For those not familiar with the New Guinean singing dog, you take a dingo, but make it opera. It's poor Verratti. So, devil's advocate question. If the dingo is a feralized dog, it arrived with the help of humans and then made a go of it here in Australia, does that mean it's native?
How long does something have to be somewhere for it to be native?
Now that is a very good question.
If you look at hares in the UK, they are often venerated as a native species, and they're supposed to be quintessentially British, and you get little hare logos on clothing that has often a lot of tweed on it, and it's like, oh, hares are great. Rabbits are terrible, and rabbits are awful, and they're the scourge of the earth, and they need to all be murdered and killed. Both were introduced to the British Isles by people. But because hares were introduced 3,000 years ago and rabbits were only introduced in the 1200s, because they were more recent, they are considered bad and worse and not native, and so we have to get rid of them.
If we take Gregor's example, given that dingoes first stepped paw in Australia at least 3,500 years ago, that's way before hares were in the British Isles. So, are we calling it native?
Look, I think it's native, and I think it's definitely part of the Australian ecosystem now.
Ewan Ritchie is a professor at Deakin University, an expert in the conservation ecology of Australian dingoes.
Other people have argued that once a species sort of becomes embedded into the ecosystem and other species recognize it, you know, by, you know, they can smell it, they can, you know, respond to it in a certain way, that it's a native animal. Now, under some criteria, any animal that is present in a region prior to 1400 AD is described as native.
What? 1400? This is the definition used, by the way, for the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act of 1999. It's an arbitrary date set about 200 years before it was thought that the Dutch first turned up in Australia. That's the native date. Anyway, back to the dingoes.
Under law, it's currently regarded as native, but other people would debate that, in part because how it got to Australia is still unsure.
Wait. Everyone just told me it was like boats 3,000 or 4,000 years ago.
We think it's been here at least 3,500 years. That's the oldest fossil that we know of. But molecular data suggests potentially 6,000 to 8,000 years or even maybe longer. So it's been here for several thousand years as a minimum. So if it got here only in the last few thousand years ago, it had to have got here with the help of people because Australia was disconnected from Papua New Guinea. But if it got here, let's say 8,000 years plus ago, it could have potentially walked across a land connection from Papua New Guinea to Australia before sea level rose.
And this is important because some people are of the opinion that if humans had any hand at all in moving things around, then that species isn't native.
So hence, yeah, while we have this huge ongoing raging debate about whether it's native or not.
And it's not the only huge ongoing raging debate connected with dingoes, because there are people out there who say that dingoes are not a separate species from domesticated dogs. This does, of course, depend on how you classify a species, which, remember, is a human concept plonked directly onto nature.
Where does a dingo fit?
Here's Professor Clive Wynn, author of Dog is Love, talking about the spectrum of species traits from wolf to domestic dog.
They look like dogs, but if you ask, what's a dingo's family structure? What kind of reproductive behaviour do dingoes show? And on every one of those questions, dingoes side with the wolves and not at all with the dogs. So dingoes are only reproductively active once a year, like wolves, not dogs. Dingoes form lasting pair bonds, like wolves, not dogs. Dingoes care for their young for an extended period, like wolves, not dogs. Dingoes, it's also fair to say, dingoes are effective hunters. They are not. I think dingoes can scavenge on human rubbish, but I don't think they do it as much as dogs. Whereas meanwhile, dingoes can and do hunt successfully without having to rely on human beings, although they can form partnerships with human beings.
So in a whole heap of biological and behavioural ways, the dingo has sort of regressed isn't the right word, but they've shed some of the domesticated traits, like last year's winter coat. Is this enough to delineate them as a species?
Depending on how you define those terms, you can choose to make dingoes fit into that, or you can choose to say the dingoes are not that.
Gregor Larson from Oxford University again.
Is a species something that is more generalized about how it fits into an ecology and this kind of ecosystem services it provides? That's a pretty functional definition, but sure, if that's what you want to go with, then fine, they are a species. So does a species have to be incapable of breeding with something else and creating fertile offspring? In which case, no, it's not a species.
Look, it's highly contentious, and canids in general make a real mess of the concept of species.
Ewan Ritchie is Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University.
As an example, wolves, coyotes, jackals, dingoes, dogs, domestic dogs, they could all interbreed and produce viable offspring.
Yeah, if you haven't listened to the earlier episodes of this series, this is your sign. It's off yap. I mean tap.
Which, according to some species concepts, like the biological species concept, mean that they're just one species. Now, no one sensible, I think, is going to argue that a chihuahua and a wolf are the same species, right? But dingoes can interbreed with other species of canid, and so that's one problem. The reality is that this rarely occurs in nature.
This flies in the face of the idea that what is referred to as wild dogs are some super hybrid dingo and dog.
So I think this sort of mythology is that there's these wild dogs out there and they're quite common and they're everywhere. And the genetic evidence just doesn't back that up. So there's been research done by Dr. Kylie Cairns and Dr. Andrew Weeks, and they've shown by looking at genetic samples of dingoes taken from across the country that dingoes actually rarely breed with domestic dogs. Mm. And in fact, in Kylie Cairns' study, she found no evidence of a true hybrid, which is a 50-50 cross.
Well, any dreams of a dingadoodle or an Australian mallarding or a dinghy, that's a dingo cross with a corgi, are shattered. Because dingoes are picky lovers.
So even though they will come into contact with each other, and particularly in some sort of rural areas where you might have loose associations of domestic dogs, sort of dogs that are sort of hanging around towns, being fed occasionally but wandering around on the outskirts of town, they would come into contact with dingoes. Despite that, they're rarely interbreeding. And there's good reason for that. First of all, when dogs move into the area of dingoes, there's very high likelihood they might be attacked and or killed because dingoes are protecting a territory that they live in. And the other thing is that domestic dogs are just really not set up well to live in Australian conditions. If you see your average dingo, it's not a big dog. It's kelpie size, 15 kilos is quite typical. When you go into the alpine areas, it might be 20 kilos, so a bit heavier because it's colder. So they need to be bigger and have heavier fur and so forth. But they only breed once a year. Now, theoretically, a domestic dog could breed more than once a year. So they actually have quite different biology. And that's probably one of the reasons why we think that dingoes are rarely choosing to breed with domestic dogs.
Okay, they're not breeding with domestic dogs much, but they're also different in other ways too. Remember Callie-Anne and her double-jointed dingo? There are physical differences too.
I don't recommend doing this, but you can actually stretch a dingo's head and it can touch the back between its where its shoulders blades are. So hyper-flexible, their jaws open really wide. They're exceptionally good climbers. You could almost think of dingoes as being almost more cat-like than they are dog-like in some of their abilities. So many people, including myself, have argued that they do deserve to be considered a species, but others would argue not.
You might be wondering, why does this matter? Because the argument about what is a species is sort of academic, right? Remember what Gregor Larson said right at the start of this episode?
There are a lot of people who have, and probably
he's choosing
right
his words carefully,
strong opinions about how dingoes are classified, because that classification has major ramifications for what people can and cannot do to them legally.
If it's a dingo and it's a protected species, or if it's a classified pest and a wild dog, that changes whether you can control them on your property. So how does the species or not argument impact the conservation treatment of Australian dingoes?
It's really central. And in fact, you will see dingoes commonly referred to as wild dogs. And that's done quite deliberately in many parts of Australia, because if you were to say to an average person, this is a dingo, I think many people would have an affinity with a dingo and probably want to conserve it in many cases. If you say it's a wild dog, it's quite a negative connotation, and many people would probably feel more supportive of controlling those animals. And that's what's been playing out across Australia for a long time.
Stock loss due to wild dogs or dingoes is a real pressure point for primary producers. Farmers have described this to me as gruesome and heartbreaking to find these animals killed. So it's worth trying to understand how bad this problem is. Do we actually have any numbers on stock losses to dingoes?
We don't have an exact number. It's actually an incredibly hard thing to determine reliably. And that's one of the reasons why there's so much controversy about controlling dingoes, is the numbers that they kill are debated. And we know that they have a really important ecological role. They control things like kangaroo numbers, feral goats, feral pigs, in some cases are killed by dingoes, so they can have these really important benefits. But of course, they do kill livestock, and that causes stress to graziers, causes financial loss, and so we want to manage that as well. But yeah, the fact that we don't have really reliable numbers on exactly how many animals are killed, it actually makes it hard to manage that problem.
Both sides of the argument can be correct. That's the worst kind of situation. It is the case that the dingo is a totally unique animal.
Professor Clive Wynne.
It ought to be protected for that reason. But at the same time, it is also true that they kill sheep and they kill cattle because they are one of the things that makes them different from typical dogs is that they are fully successful, effective hunters. How do you square that circle? Both those things are true.
So this creates a difficult situation for governmental organisations who organise the conservation gradings. How do you balance the needs of the dingoes with the needs of the agricultural sector?
The conservation and legal status of dingoes is very complex and it's really variable across Australia. Even as an example in Victoria where I live, dingoes are protected, but in the eastern part of the state, they have what's called an unprotection order, which means that control of dingoes can occur on both public and private land. In the northwest of the state, that unprotection order has recently been removed, which means that they're now protected on public and private land.
You follow that? Protected, but then not, but then reprotected, but only in some places. And that's just Victoria.
Other states, such as South Australia, the dingo is actually basically declared a pest. And under the fence, the dingo barrier fence, which ranges for more than 5,500 kilometres, the aim there is to eradicate dingoes. So it actually states to eradicate. The conservation and management of dingoes varies quite widely.
And the survival or not of the dingo impacts more than the wild canines of Australia. In some cases, the presence of dingoes can suppress pests like foxes and cats and benefit conservation of other species like hopping mice or bilbies.
It's also really important to understand that dingoes are central to many First Nations peoples and their culture, and they regard the term wild dog as offensive. Dingoes are often thought of as kin by First Nations peoples, so it's really important that we remember that too in these conversations.
We're back with Wadawurrung woman Kellyanne Blake and Jack the dingo.
Yeah, he is part of my story. He is part of my cultural connection to this land and my culture, my Wadawurrung culture.
Is there a Wadawurrung word for dingo?
Yes. So Dawal is dingo in the sense of free or wild, non-tame dingo. And then we have Gal, which is camp dingo or companion dingo. From what I have discovered through my journey is that women and their relationship with dingoes, they have been drawn to the camp dingo, getting the young and taking them and raising them to the point even suckling them themselves. Oh. Yes, to be, they will never be domesticated, but it's more tame. So the dingoes come and go as they please, but knowing that the camp is home and that they return home and they become living blanket warmers. So have you ever heard of the saying, it's three dog night?
Yeah.
That's what it literally meant. There's three dingoes around you and on you to keep you warm in the cold. It was a lot of elderly women would have dingoes around them. Like after childbearing age, it was like they'd have six or seven because it was like they'd be around the women from arthritis and being like little hot packs. And yeah, and that's the connection with women.
The dingo's ability to live wild and also live in close proximity to humans, to contain the multitudes of those relationships, is one of the reasons that this animal is so unique and also why the conservation efforts are complex. Kellyanne has recently become a co-litigant suing the Victorian government, arguing that the dingo control measures cause cultural suffering.
It has been ignored because we've really focused on the ecological. Some people have focused on the ecological benefits and how dingo can balance country, a bit like the wolf in Yellowstone, right? But what we haven't touched upon is the cultural connection to dingo. Dingo in ceremony, dingo used in sky country astronomy, dingo in rock art, dingo in used as adornments within ceremony, dingo as kin. So bringing all of those cultural themes to the light is a human rights issue. It's actually a human rights issue. So if you think about it, the cultural connection to dingo is spiritual connection to dingo, which is religious connection to dingo. And by taking away dingo or not allowing our connection with dingo to continue or to be happening, that's, I guess, taking away human rights for Indigenous people.
What the Duck is made within the Science Unit at ABC Radio National. My name's Anne Jones, and I work on it, along with a revolving cast of people, Nat Tenchich, Rebecca McLaren, Jacinta Bowler, and Patria Ladgrove.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.